Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. As regular listeners to this program know, we feel one of the most important fronts in that war is the home front, the security of the people of the United States and our country. One of the greatest threats to that community, Americans, those of us who love freedom and live in this country, is unfortunately all too little appreciated. It is a threat to the most critical of our critical infrastructures. I'm very pleased to welcome, I think for the first time, to our microphones, Representative Lou Barletta. He represents the people of the 11th District of my home state, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. He formerly served as the mayor of Hazleton, Pennsylvania, and therefore has a special appreciation of what government is like at the state and, of course, most especially the local level. He brings that background to bear an important responsibility. He is the chairman of the Economic Development, Public Buildings, and Emergency Management Subcommittee of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. He is also a member of the Homeland Security Committee, where he serves on its counterterrorism and intelligence subcommittees. I'm very, very grateful to have you back with here with us, sir, especially in the aftermath of your recent hearing into all of these matters in your subcommittee. Welcome, and tell us about that hearing, if you would, Congressman Barletta.
Sure, Frank. It's great to spend some time with you. And you know, as you mentioned, I sit in a very unique situation, I believe, as a mayor for 11 years in having to deal with disasters and emergency preparedness. And then also on Homeland Security, where I'm briefed about the possible threats to our homeland, and then as the chairman of a subcommittee that has to deal with emergency management. So the first thing that came to my mind is, how ready are we if there's an attack on the side, a cyber attack on our electrical grid, as well as combining that with a physical attack, and are we ready on the ground as mayors and supervisors? What does this mean? And so I decided to hold a hearing to bring in experts to really have that discussion. And it was very, I think it was very interesting and something that we need to continue talking about.
Well, let me ask you about some of the particular problems that I hope your hearing addressed, in addition to the two that you've mentioned, which are very troubling, of course, the cyber warfare threat. We know people, hostile nations, perhaps others, have been inside some of our electric control systems through cyber means. Physical attacks, of course, we had a very close call out in Northern California a couple of years ago, and other threats have manifested themselves. But did your subcommittee have a chance to look into two other problems, the electromagnetic pulse phenomenon and this problem that if nobody attacks us with one or the other of these means, Congressman Barletta, the sun is going to do it in the form of an intense solar storm at some point in the foreseeable future?
We did not get into that. We just focused on a major cyber attack, and also to add to that, which could be devastating, is a physical attack along with a cyber attack. If somebody wanted to do damage to America, something like this would happen. How long can we expect to be without power? And testimony that we heard indicated that we would be measuring the power outage in weeks, not days. And I think that's very that's very interesting. I mean, you can imagine our wastewater treatment services, our healthcare delivery, financial services, transportation. What can happen in a community if we're talking about no power in a portion of our country, not just a community, a portion of our country for weeks and not days? And are the local officials prepared for this. That's when loss of life will happen, most likely, will be in the first instant. And it's not like a storm that's coming where you can get prepared for this and you know it's coming and you have an idea of how long you need to be prepared for. But something like a cyber attack can happen in the middle of the night tonight. It can happen a couple seconds from now. How prepared are we, and how much coordination with the federal government is actually going on with the people on the ground in municipalities? And I think we have work to do.
We're speaking with Congressman Lou Barletta of the 11th District of Pennsylvania, the chairman of the Economic Development, Public Buildings, and Emergency Management Subcommittee of the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. Congressman, you have, as I indicated, background in emergency management at the local level, of course, as a mayor of Hazleton. To the extent we have work to do, sir, do you feel that the federal government is adequately seized with the need for that work? Do they understand the magnitude of the problem here, or are we really basically saying to these state and local government agencies, you're pretty much on your own if this bad thing happens through one means or another?
Well, my sense has been that as I said, we need to have further conversations with people on the local level who will be in charge when it first happens. The FBI and DHS are hosting briefings for law enforcement, energy companies, and local governments to discuss strategies for mitigating the risk, providing better defense and disaster reactions. But and talking to the the energy companies, I think they are very well prepared. But I still believe, Frank, that there's work to be done with people in our local communities. If anyone listening has an opportunity to talk to their local officials, I'd be interested to know how well prepared they are for weeks of no power. And did they know that? Most communities probably don't even know that, how long they need to be prepared for. And that's the key. We can be prepared if we know what to expect in the event that it happens. And I think, we need to make people aware. And I think local municipalities, townships, rural areas who will be affected for a long period of time, I'm concerned that that's when loss of life will occur and the most damage. I think we need a lot more conversation with people at the local level with the federal government.
Amen to that. And thank you so much for your leadership on this. I will tell you that in my experience, Congressman, and I think that of the Secure the Grid Coalition, which we've helped form to try to provide a sort of second opinion on a lot of this and would welcome a chance to brief you on its findings so far. But the assurances that many of your colleagues and you obviously have received from the utilities that they're prepared, they've got this under control, not to worry, is really misplaced. It seems as though North American Electric Reliability Corporation, which sort of represents them and is supposed to be their regulator, as well as the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, have been whistling past the graveyard a lot on this. So I think if you do that sort of drill down, and I couldn't agree with you more about the necessity of really talking to those who are going to have to pick up the pieces about how prepared they are and do they really understand this problem. But it seems as though there's a certain hope that none of this is going to happen, but hope is not a strategy, as they say.
No, and I think that the telling part of the hearing, why I feel that there's really not that coordination as far as it needs to be from the federal government, state to locals. This was the first time in the hearing that we heard any type of time frame that could be possible when we heard weeks and not days. So the fact that was new news lends me to believe that how could anybody be ready on the ground at the local level if they didn't know or don't know how long they need to be prepared for? Water, gas. I mean, what happens when there's no longer gas, to get help to people, and what's the plan for that? They may say that we're prepared, but I believe we got work to do yet.
I just will tell you the thing that makes those weeks sound to me to be greatly understated, bad as that would be, is if these high-voltage transformers that are the backbone of the electric grid, as you know, are seriously damaged in any number, that's a much longer-term problem than weeks. We will be following this closely and commending you for your work and looking forward to collaborating with you in it. Congressman Lou Barletta, thank you for taking a few minutes to report on your hearing last week. Keep up the good work and come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, former Green Beret Jim Hansen joins us. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by Jim Hansen, our executive vice president at the Center for Security Policy, a man who frequently guest hosts this program, for which I'm very grateful. He is also a special operator, United States Army Green Beret, and a man who has brought for years now to this program and to his work a common sense boots on the ground perspective on all things that we prize, and I think so does our audience. Jim, thanks so much for joining us. Good to have you with us as always.
Yep, pleasure, Frank.
You've recently written about the latest developments in Iraq and specifically what the likely beneficiary is thereof, namely Iran. Another American serviceman, in fact, another special operator was lost there yesterday. Give us a flavor, Jim, of what's happening on the ground now, this decision of the president to assign 250 more people to the fight in Syria, and is Iran likely to be the beneficiary there as well?
No doubt, Frank. I think the problem with everything that's going on in that theater falls back into President Obama's lap for his mistaken, misguided, and horrifyingly bad decision to remove us from Iraq, to remove combat forces, to cut and run, and to walk away from a victory. He lost the peace. And in doing so, everyone who had above room temperature IQ pointed out two groups would benefit: Iran and the Sunni extremists who we had just defeated. Both of those things have now come true, and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands perhaps are dead, millions of refugees. And the only ones who are likely to end up with a power gain out of it are the Iranian mullahs, who are hardly a force for peace.
Hardly indeed. And yet what we're watching at the same time that the president has, as you say, lost the peace in Iraq and seems to be in free fall there, he is greatly enhancing the power and emboldening the government of Tehran. So what is the likelihood, Jim, that this gets any better anytime soon, not just in neighboring Iraq, but throughout that region?
It absolutely will not. There is no conceivable scenario that this gets better absent a complete change in U.S. policy. and that requires a new president. So we'll see what the election brings. But the current situation is going to result in the Iranians becoming a more hegemonic power. The funny thing is, the recent protests in Baghdad, where Muqtada Sadr's militia and political party stormed into the Green Zone and actually took over Iraqi parliament for a while, have been reported as being anti-Iranian protests, which is comical when you think about the fact that Sadr ran away from Iraq in 2007 and spent the next 4 years safely ensconced in Iran working on his theological studies. And his group is largely funded by the Iranian mullahs. So they may be chanting anti-Iranian slogans, but the mullahs are happy with what's going on, because if the Iraqi government is either toppled or changed in any way, it will be the Shia majority and the Shia militias and the Iranian influence groups that are all going to benefit. And the Sunnis and Kurds are going to take the brunt of that.
Let me ask you about something, Jim, that has been a hardy perennial of American policy, and that is that the Sunnis and Shia, as you have said, are often at each other's throats, notably in connection with Iran and Iraq. What we're also hearing, though, is that the Sunnis and Shiites have been perfectly willing to engage in common operations against us, notably on the occasion of 9/11, the attack that toppled the World Trade Centers and attack the Pentagon and so on. What do we know about the nature of this sectarian divide, Jim, and whether we've gotten to the bottom of it with respect to 9/11, for example, or more broadly, whether we really understand it in its full dynamic?
Well, I think it's a classic example of the me and my buddies against the rest of the squad, our squad against the rest of the platoon, our platoon against the rest of the company. They are friends when it is in their advantage to do so. But when they've got a larger enemy, in this case, the external world, they're perfectly willing to partner up with the guys that they might fight with internally. But against the great Satan or the little Satan, all of a sudden, those Saudis aren't as bad, or the Qataris, or any of the rest of the Gulf Arab states. They will partner in useful ways when it's to their greater good. Now, I think in the end, both of them think they'll become victorious. You know, both the Arab states and the Sunni side and the Shia think in the end they are the true holders of Islam. But in the intervening times, they'll partner against us when it's their mutual advantage, for sure.
Let me ask you about one particularly toxic group within that Sunni community, namely the Muslim Brotherhood. And you've recently written, Jim, about whether they, in fact, should qualify under U.S. law as a terrorist organization. And yet we're told by the administration and others, apologists, I guess you might call them, for the Brotherhood, that no. These are people who have eschewed violence and therefore wouldn't qualify, and more to the point, ought to be relied upon, really, to be part of the solution to the jihadist threat that we're facing in the name of terrorism.
Well, that's really the scariest thing about the Obama administration, Frank, is they can look at a group like the Muslim Brotherhood and, okay, they can put out a press release and say, we no longer commit violence, which means that they put on their nice clothes and took off their tracksuits and they're not personally lopping off heads, but they support the guys who are. They organize with the guys who are, and they incite the guys who are and the rest of the Muslim world to support them. They fund the groups that are engaged in the other kind of jihad, not the violent kind, the civilization jihad. And the Brotherhood invented that term. They have a long-standing, well-established, very successful plan to push that agenda in much of the free West. And consequently, they are actually a bigger danger in the long term to the free world than the violent jihadists. If we really decided that tomorrow we're going to kill ISIS, we could kill them in 6 months. We could roll through there and get medieval on them and wipe them out. The civilization jihad is a much more complicated long war, and that's the Brotherhood's game. And they have a number of front groups pushing that agenda in Europe and in the United States, and that's where we really need to focus our attention.
Let me ask you about one of them, Jim, because it was much in evidence on Capitol Hill back on the 18th of April, I believe, namely something called the U.S. Council of Muslim Organizations. What is that outfit? What is its purpose? And how does this team fit into that larger shared purpose with the violent jihadists of imposing Sharia worldwide and creating a caliphate to rule according to?
The USCMO is what you could easily say is a collection of the usual suspects. It's CARE and ICNA and the Muslim American Society and all the folks who have historically been pushing this agenda of imposing Sharia and pushing civilization jihad. And they've decided that, hey, one of the ways to subvert our country from within, which is what civilization jihad is to use the political process. So they formed what's essentially a political lobbying organization, and they were on Capitol Hill walking around doing what all Americans can do. You can petition your government for the redress of grievances. But if it's a group whose goal is to impose a system that is counter-constitutional, I think people should take a little bit closer look at that and decide whether or not that's something we want happening. We don't want Sharia law, and if these guys are pushing it, maybe we need to take a look at those organizations and decide whether they are simply exercising their free speech or whether they're subverting our country from within. I'm pretty sure it's the latter.
Thanks for all of that, Jim. Keep it up and come back to us again very soon. Next up, syndicated radio show host Sandy Rios joins us right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. One of the most insidious legislative initiatives of the Obama years, and that's saying something, is pending legislation increasingly known as the Jailbreak Bill. Its progress through a Republican-led Congress relies on false pretenses to put tens of thousands of hardened felons back on the streets and probably back in the business of violent crime. One example of this fraud is its supporters' recent rollout of a new group called Conservatives for Safety and Opportunity. Turning loose large numbers of drug traffickers is something that could be supported only by conservatives and other Republicans, libertarians, and Americans more generally who are indifferent to the opportunity it creates for endangering our safety. Add into the mix that at least some of the felons this so-called criminal justice reform legislation would spring have been converted to Sharia in prison, and you have jailbreak for jihadists. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is a distinct pleasure to have with us a woman that I've had the privilege of knowing as a friend and colleague for many years and occasionally been a guest on her radio program, Sandy Rios in the Morning, heard on the American Family Radio Network. She is the Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association and has been so active on so many fronts for so long in Washington, D.C., and with such great effect that it really is a privilege to have a chance to talk to her on our show for a change. And I also want to say she is the kind host of our Secure Freedom Minute, heard on this program, but more importantly, heard on the many outlets that pick up and carry her wonderful program, Sandy Rios in the Morning. Sandy, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's always great to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. This is interesting role reversal, isn't it?
Yeah, turnabout is fair play, as they say. Listen, you were such an incredibly important part of an effort that our team made at the recent National Religious Broadcasters Convention. We talked there about the threat of the global jihad movement, specifically what it means for Christians, but for everybody else, for that matter, not just so-called infidels, but Muslims as well. I'd love to get your thoughts, Sandy, about both what you think is at stake here and what those of us who, whether we're Christians or not, should be thinking about and doing to protect our country against this jihadist threat.
Well, it's interesting, Frank, that all the battles that we're facing seem to kind of go back to one theme, and that is control of our thoughts. and control of what we say. You know, it's as though they like to tell us that we can think what we want in our heads. We just can't act on it. So that they're trying to control language and adjectives, and even Hillary Clinton was hit, you know, on this ridiculous, you know, not getting off the reservation remark she made recently. But now we are not allowed to have an opinion, or certainly to verbalize an opinion, on the most basic things, from Islam to the bathroom preferences. It's just, it's amazing. It's like it is totalitarian in every way. It is thought control. And certainly in the area of Islam, there is direct physical danger, where when we cannot speak what is true, what we know about Sharia, what we know about what happens in countries that practice Sharia, we can't speak of it, we can't allude to it, we can't wonder about if people who live in our midst embrace it and are planning danger for us. We can't talk about that. This brings a real physical danger more imminent than the other issues that we face on, you know, radical sexual behaviors and bathrooms and all of that, which are also very important.
I want to come back to that, Sandy, but what you really struck upon here is a sort of interesting, well, dynamic, I guess, and that is the connection between, on the one hand, out and outright hostile, threatening, even violent totalitarians like the Sharia adherent Muslims, on the one hand, and their enablers on the left, who have done much to essentially establish what can be said and what can't be said in our own country, so-called political correctness. But it really amounts to submission to the jihadis on the one hand, and the enforcement of a kind of thought control by the leftists with whom they partner. And freedom of speech is really right at the core of it. You exercise it magnificently every day for a couple of hours on some 200 stations across the country. And yet, I think you too have found yourself under attack, if I'm not mistaken, for things that you've said or positions that you've taken. And what is the enforcement mechanism that we should be alive to and pushing back against, Sandy?
Well, I think always, Frank, just speaking up, speaking the truth, whether, you know, you and I do it in public venues, as you described every day, we have this opportunity. But I would say for the average person, I always say, talk about these things to your friends. Talk about them to your families. Talk about them in restaurants. Talk about them at schools. Stop being afraid to speak the truth. I'm not talking about being obnoxious, like we've seen in some of these political demonstrations, rude and overbearing. But I'm talking about speaking the truth steadily, steadily, drip by drip, refusing to be silent on these very important issues. We have great power to influence our friends and family members. And when we go silent on these basic issues, then we are cooperating with what will become a more totalitarian movement, a more powerful movement, if we don't exercise it in our private and personal lives right now.
You know, when I'm thinking about enforcement, I'm kind of thinking about that issue you've alluded to here a couple of times. I know you're right in the thick of the debate about this absolutely bizarre action that's now underway to essentially force everyone in their most intimate settings, in bathrooms and locker rooms and the like, into a position where, in deference to tiny, tiny, tiny minority, they must put themselves not only at risk of embarrassment, perhaps, but a physical danger. And the thought police that are now imposing this transgender agenda, I guess you'd call it, on all of us, are engaged in really quite a prime example of this phenomenon we're talking about, of a kind of totalitarianism, isn't it?
It most definitely is. You mentioned, have I had some mistreatment, you know, Frank, because of the stands I've taken on so many issues of speaking the truth, as I believe there is truth, and I've made it my life's work to speak it without hedging ever. And there is such blowback. You know, there's punishment. There's there are jobs lost. There are bad things said about you. There are threats, threats of death, physical violence. There are criticisms for women. It's always attacks on your appearance. And, oh, I've had the whole range of things, no question about it. Because for whatever reason, this common spirit we've just described that drives shutting us up about the dangers of Islam drives shutting us up about the dangers of I guess, sexual chaos. I guess I could say that, or the destruction of family. And so, yes, when we start fighting back on these issues, there's huge blowback, and it's very, very ugly. It's obscene. But on the issue of transgender bathrooms, it's interesting. I believe that we have struck on an issue where people are just not quite ready to go there yet. In the issue of Target, this store that so many of us enjoy, opening up their dressing rooms as well as their bathrooms to men and women without regard to their physical attributes, this has created quite a firestorm. And I'll just, to be practical, the American Family Association has laid down the gauntlet. The day after we did that, and we started getting signatures from people willing to say, I'm not shopping there till they change their policy, not doing it. AFA's request was simply that they provide a family bathroom that's genderless for people who are in a confused situation about their sexuality and not mess with the privacy, historical significance of privacy in bathrooms. And maintain male and female bathrooms. So already, within a few, really 24 hours, 48 hours, Frank, we had 700,000 signatures. Now we have 1.2 million signatures, and it's growing.
Sandy, we're talking about freedom of speech. You're giving voice to, now over a million Americans. And I think we just have to be clear. This isn't about some kind of insensitivity or intolerance. This is about a fundamental privacy right, and the fact that those would insist that that be dispensed with in deference to some manufactured right of individuals who, as you say, seem to have their own issues is really a sort of symptom of a much larger problem, I think, in our society. So I just wanted to say thank you, Sandy, for both joining us today and for the work you do at the American Family Association and, of course, on the Sandy Rios in the Morning program on AFR Talk. Keep it up.
Can I interrupt you just for a second? Just if people want to join this petition, because it is having great effect, it's AFA.net, AFA.net if they want to join our boycott of Target.
I appreciate that very much, Sandy. Keep up the great work. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll be talking with Michael Cutler about immigration, security, and more. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, I'm very pleased to say, joined once again by Michael Cutler, one of our go-to guys by virtue of his extensive experience with immigration and naturalization issues. In fact, he worked for the Immigration and Naturalization Service for 30 years, including as an inspector at JFK Airport. These days, he is a senior fellow at Californians for Population Stabilization and a mighty contributor to the public policy debate about these issues, notably in a column that he writes at Front Page Magazine. He contributes frequently to Social Contract. In fact, an upcoming edition of that magazine will feature one of his pieces about the art of the question. And we'll talk with him more about that shortly. And also Family Security Matters. Michael Cutler, welcome back. It's good to have you with us as always.
Always a pleasure to join you, Frank. Thanks for all the work you're doing in getting the word out about so many of the challenges and threats that America and America faces today.
Well, it's a team effort, needless to say. And one of the things that I wanted to call attention to is an important piece that you've written about immigration failure by design. This is an important insight into what's been going on here for some years under administrations of both parties, as I understand it. Give us a sense of sort of the macro problem we're facing, Michael.
Sure. I mean, you know, we hear the simplistic thing about let's build a fence on the border. And if we could hermetically seal that border, you know, thinking about the old Johnny Carson Ed McMahon routine about hermetically sealed, or get the deflector shield off the Starship Enterprise, our immigration crisis would not be ended. Do we need to secure the Mexican border? Absolutely. And by the way, isn't it remarkable that it took us 44 months to win the Second World War, build fleets of aircraft, thousands of airplanes, thousands of ships, nuclear weapons with brand new technology, 44 months it was over. We were attacked numerous times, or we've been attacked numerous times over the past decades by foreign nationals who easily gamed the visa process, gained entry into the United States, and went about their deadly preparations. And we've done nothing about it. Because, look, the goal has been to bring in three things: cheap labor, lots of foreign students, and lots of foreign tourists. And if you look at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, if you look at the other special interest groups, lobbying groups, if you will, that provide massive campaign contributions, which are little more than thinly described veiled bribes, they want to make money, and they're willing to do it at the cost, literally, of American lives. And we know that we're at risk. If you look at the 9/11 Commission report, and you know I provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission, I've been before numerous congressional hearings in the House and Senate, these issues are all well known to everybody, and yet we've never addressed the issue. The biggest failure of immigration is the enforcement of our laws from within the interior of the United States to go after visa fraud, immigration benefit fraud. You know, the 9/11 Commission warned about laxity in the visa process. We had 26 visa waiver countries on 9/11. We now have 38 visa waiver countries. There should be zero visa waiver countries.
And most especially, I guess, we also must enforce the law with respect to visa overstays, which is
but that's inferior enforcement. But that's the point. But that's exactly right. Because, you know, none of the 9/11 terrorists, and very few terrorists who attempted to carry out or succeeded in carrying out attacks ran the Mexican border. Faisal Shahzad, the Times Square bomber, was admitted on a student visa. We naturalized him. And then months after we gave him citizenship, he set off a car bomb in Times Square. The Tsarnaev brothers, the same deal. They came here. They got political asylum. They promptly went back to Russia. Obviously, their claim of credible fear was nonsense. And then they launched that deadly attack in Boston. You have the San Bernardino terrorist attack. This guy brings in his fiancée on a K-1 visa for fiancés and promptly sets about going on a murderous rampage. And now, most recently, just a couple of days ago, members of his family were involved in a marriage fraud scam, including the guy who is alleged to have provided weapons and other material support to these terrorists. So we keep seeing fraud as being a huge issue. When was the last time you heard anybody discuss immigration fraud in the public arena, whether in the media or by the politicians?
We're talking with Michael Cutler, experienced career Immigration and Naturalization Services professional. These days, he is a senior fellow at Californians for Population Stabilization. But just staying with this sort of broad assessment of where we are. You've also written, while there's plenty of blame to go around here with respect to both parties seeming for perhaps different reasons, whether it's jobs or votes or demographic change, that they have been, these laws, particularly undermined, and our national security as well, as you've written at Front Page Magazine, Michael Cutler, by the Obama administration. Give us a flavor of that, if you would.
Well, you know, it's amazing. If you look at the nonsense about the Dreamers, and by the way, isn't it remarkable that if you dare utter the word alien in conjunction with immigration, you're chastised, you're referred to by some pretty nasty language. But, you know, the A in Dreamer is alien miners, because they needed an A to conjure up this image of the American dream. The unpalatable, terrible word of alien suddenly became palatable. And it's not about children. When Obama delivered that speech back in 2012, June of 2012 in the Rose Garden, he kept talking about, this is about young people, children, kids. The age cutoff is 31. These are aliens who came into the country without inspection. That was the term agents used. Aliens who enter without inspection, EWI. They are trespassing. There is no vetting process. We're not certain as to their names or even their nationalities. And remarkably, the Obama administration gave hundreds of thousands of dreamers lawful status without so much as a face-to-face interview, let alone a field investigation. The approval rate runs to more than 95%. Think about the national security risk that this imposes on America and Americans. And here's something else to think about when you think, well, how many people do we have to worry about? It took just 19 young terrorists on 9/11 to inflict more casualties than did the entire Japanese Navy at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. We've admitted hundreds of, or we've given hundreds of thousands of men and women who snuck into the country lawful status temporarily, but identity documents that enable them to then go out and get driver's licenses, social security cards, build a whole biography, if you will, that may be totally bogus. Imagine the damage that does to national security.
Yeah, no, this really does have ominous implications. And one of the other pieces of this, and you sort of touched on it there a moment ago, the vetting that we're assured is being done of those that the president is bringing in legally from Syria seems to leave a lot to be desired, too. Even if they're going through the motions, the effect may be pretty much the same as what they're doing, which is to say nothing with respect to the dreamers.
Yeah, James Comey, the head of the FBI, said that there is no way to screen these people. Now, originally they said, well, we're spending 18 to 24 months. Basically, it's an exercise in futility. But now they're zipping them through in 90 days. So even when they say we're doing something, they don't do it. Just like when they said this is about the children and it wasn't, and we're going to go after the criminals. Well, there was a hearing on April the 19th, the day after the Supreme Court heard oral arguments about the president's, I believe, illegal executive orders. And this focused on the victims, on the families of the victims of people who were killed by criminal aliens.
And that's where I want to pick up with you, Michael Cutler. We have to pause for just a moment. When we come back, I want to talk about the real impact of this kind of behavior by Republicans and Democrats with respect to the laws of the land, immigration laws most especially, and the effect on public safety. That and more with Michael Cutler right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by a career immigration and naturalization service professional, 30 years standing, former immigration inspector at JFK Airport, and a man who worked closely with the Drug Enforcement Agency in New York, including rising to the rank of senior special agent. He is these days a senior fellow at Californians for Population Stabilization. His name, of course, is Michael Cutler. And Michael, again, thank you so much for your time and for giving us two opportunities to talk with you about all of this. Let me begin by just picking up where we left off, and that is we're clearly seeing threats to public safety, national security too, I believe, but even just individual citizens are now at greater risk, whether it's from illegal aliens who are being allowed to stay here, some of whom are gang members or other criminal operators. We also have the problem of people being let out of prison, especially if, again, bipartisan majorities have their way in the Congress, on reduced sentences. Again, speak to us about what this might mean in terms of more victims and how we should handle it.
Well, you know, look, as you pointed out, I spent nearly half my career with the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force. I did a four-year stint as the first immigration agent assigned to the Unified Intelligence Division of DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration in New York City. The nexus between drug smuggling and alien smuggling it permeates. Both overlap with the other. And very often illegal aliens are forced into carrying loads of narcotics into the United States. And if you look at who runs the drug gangs, the people at the top of the food chain almost invariably are foreign nationals, which makes sense. The drug cartels want to make certain that they don't lose control of either the drugs or the proceeds, the money. So the best way to do that is to bring in people from the countries that they're from, because the bad guys that work for them know that if they, you know, shortchange them, as it were, their family is going to be killed. So what better control can you have over someone than to say, listen, you're going to be square with me or you're going to lose your family? And they do that frequently.
We know where you live, as they say, right?
Absolutely. So they've got this powerful control over the people that are in their employment. And I was in shock because I decided to do an analysis of arrest statistics. And this was back in the late 80s, early 90s. In New York City, you know, this notion of the border states, we have 50 border states. Any state with an international airport or seaport is as much a border state as those along the northern and southern borders. New York, guess what percentage of the people we were arresting at DEA in New York City at the task force were foreign-born? 60%. Now, understand what we're talking about. The nexus between international terrorism, transnational crime, narcotics, and violence are all linked together. And if you want to really go after the violence, this nonsense where you count how many bullets law-abiding citizens can put in their firearms, drug dealers, crazy people, and terrorists aren't counting how many rounds are going into their illegally owned firearms. If you want to go after the violence, go after the drugs, go after the gangs. And what does that mean? Immigration enforcement. And I don't know if you know this, but the second greatest number of agents on the Joint Terrorism Task Force from Homeland, from DHS, rather from ICE, a part of DHS, working closely with the FBI. Yet we have very few interior enforcement agents to lend real integrity to the immigration system. And that's really where everything falls apart.
We're joined by a career immigration and naturalization service professional. His name, of course, is Michael Cutler. And Michael, let me ask you, when you hear people on Capitol Hill these days, some of them Republicans, as well as Democrats, talking about releasing tens of thousands of felons early, shorter service of their sentences than would otherwise be required, then you are assured not to worry. They're nonviolent drug offenders, which makes it sound like they're people who, you know, just got caught with a dime bag somehow and managed to wind up in federal prison. Do a sanity check on that for us, both with respect to who are these folks and what the likelihood is if they get out that they will return to serious, including violent, criminal activity.
Well, if in fact we're talking about somebody who was caught with a small quantity, not selling, probably there's a better way of dealing with those folks. Okay, we do have a problem with massive jail populations, and we've privatized some of our prisons. I hate seeing the profit motive rear its head within our criminal justice system.
But those guys aren't in federal prison, as I understand it.
Not generally, no. And so what I'm going to suggest is this. If somebody is arrested and charged with enough that he was selling the drugs, more than likely, there was a plea bargain So perhaps the firearm charge was thrown out. Perhaps the extortion charges were thrown out. If you're selling drugs, these are not Boy Scouts that were in the wrong place on the wrong day. These are bad people. And when we're dealing with foreign nationals that commit crime, you know, everybody worries about recidivism, the guy that gets back on the street and commits more crime. There's a solution to recidivism. It's called deportation or removal, as it's now referred to. If you take somebody out of the United States, then there's no way that he can commit more crimes. And if he comes back, then he's committing the crime of unlawful reentry, which carries a 20-year maximum penalty. And by the way, I worked with Senator Al D'Amato way back in the early 80s to help create that law. And up until the nonsense pulled by the Obama administration in 2010, believe it or not, 30% of all federal prosecutions were for violation of that specific statute. And that's the way that you deter people. It's through enforcement, not by giving people back rubs, but by enforcing the law and making it clear that there are consequences when you violate our laws, especially where the laws involve violence, narcotics, that sort of thing.
Right. Hey, Michael, very quickly, I mentioned earlier that you have a piece coming out in The Social Contract about the art of the question. Talk very quickly, if you would, about the importance of having these felons and the importance of having our politicians challenged on these sorts of issues and you know, answer tough questions about them.
Well, you know, here's the point. Very often politicians are willing to spend lots of taxpayer money to create the illusion that they're doing what the American people want, but they don't really do it. Look, we know that, for example, drones on the border are a disaster. They don't work. They're very costly. You could put up four helicopters with armed border patrol agents on board for the price of one drone. It takes 17 people to operate the drone. And as soon as the study that was done at the behest of a senator who was retiring, the Obama administration went out and bought more drones. Why wouldn't you be using the most cost-effective solution? You don't do it that way when you don't want the solution. You want to create the illusion of doing what the constituents want, but making certain you maintain status quo. Therein lies the problem. The American people have got to become savvy and knowledgeable so they can ask the questions and know when they're being bamboozled by these characters.
Amen. Michael Cutler, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. This is such an important topic. As with so many other aspects of our national and homeland security, it really cannot be said often enough that the voters need to establish what is the thinking and what would be the program of those that they might entrust with the highest offices in the land, the job of Commander-in-Chief most especially. I appreciate your clarity on these matters, and you're helping the rest of us get clear about them as well. I hope that you'll come back to us again very soon, and that the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.